Well, happy birthday, Gary. And also, I think it's very fitting that General Relativity and Gary all together are having celebration the same year. And I'm going to talk today about something I've been working on for a while, which began with some seminal work of Gary's several essays. So investigations in string theory over the last few decades have produced a lot of very powerful mathematical relationships, which are mathematical truths independent of the status of string theory as the theory of nature. And in my opinion, the prospects for some kind of direct verification of string theory as the theory of nature are remote in the near future, but these things that we've learned from studying string theory have already had significant applications in a number of fields: mathematics, condensed matter physics, nuclear physics, general relativity. And oddly, one of the things that has been left out of the mix here is astronomy. And one of the most famous relationships to come out of string theory, the ADS-CFT correspondence, has a similar but much less understood cousin, the Kerr-CFT correspondence, which was inspired by a seminal paper of Gary and Bardeen in 1999. And in this talk, I'm going to discuss recent work trying to find observational signals of this correspondence. So the outline is, first I'm going to talk about the general problem of finding scaling limits and critical behavior in astrophysics. And then I'm going to talk about how extreme Kerr black holes are a critical system that we can see in the sky. And therefore, we should be able to apply various applications of this, including to gravity wave emission, which might be measured at ELISA or some kind of advanced LIGO, to black hole energy extraction, and most recently about possible predictions for the Event Horizon Telescope. And then I'll conclude with some comments. So condensed matter physics, like astrophysics, deals with complicated systems with many degrees of freedom that we can't hope to understand in a complete and detailed way. And progress in condensed matter physics, the whole subject, focuses on special extreme situations where critical behavior occurs. And these often happens for special values of temperatures, magnetic fields, various external parameters. And so this has been going on for centuries. A famous example is the critical opalescence of carbon at the liquid gas transition, where it suddenly becomes opaque. So at these critical points, very dramatic things can happen, and they are often, or maybe almost always, accompanied by some kind of enhanced symmetry. Another example is that's important and will be relevant to what I'm going to say in the following is scaling symmetries, for example, which occur in the Ising model. I don't need to explain this to much of the audience here, but it's kind of trivial that you get, if you look at very long distances at the Ising model, that you get a scaling symmetry. Much more interesting and non-trivial is that you get this infinite dimensional symmetry. And Zamolodchikov and Polchinski showed that this infinite dimensional symmetry almost always has to, under a large variety of circumstances, always, almost always has to accompany the scale symmetry. And this has been very important and experimentally relevant in the study of two-dimensional conformal field theories. Now, there's data and information literally raining down out of the sky about all kinds of astrophysical systems that we really don't understand. And so where is the critical behavior hiding in all these things that are being seen in the sky? Well, there is already one very well understood example that isn't usually phrased in this way, and that's the CMB fluctuations. And according to the theory of inflation, if we go to high redshift, which is early times, notice going to high redshift is the same thing as going to low energies. It's like what we do with a condensed matter system. According to the theory of inflation, there's a conformally invariant fixed point there, something which has an SO4,1 conformal group that is the symmetry group of De Sitter space that appears in inflation, and that has a very robust experimental consequence which has now been observed. So this is one example of critical behavior that occurs in the sky. In this talk, I am going to talk about another area of low energies and high redshifts that we are just beginning to see in the sky, and in the coming decades, we will be able to study with great precision. And in fact, nobody quite knows the limit to, the precision seems to be doubling every few years, and nobody quite knows how well we're going to be able to resolve these things. But unlike in the accelerator world that we're used to, there isn't any obvious obstacle to getting really a huge increases in the precision. And we're going to see that at this region of high redshift, the near horizon of an extremely rotating Kerr black hole, that this same infinite dimensional enhanced symmetry that occurs in the Ising model appears. And so the question is, what are the observational consequences of that? So let me give a warm up. This is a very mixed audience. And of course, it's a tribute to Gary that it's impossible to give because he knows so many people in many different fields, that it's impossible to assume anything about everybody in the audience. So I think everybody will be put to sleep every third slide. So there's something called the Riesner-Nordström black hole, the extreme Riesner-Nordström black hole, which was discovered probably in the 40s or 50s. And it has the property that if you go very near the horizon of the black hole, there's a region of high redshift where there's a scaling solution. So extreme Riesner-Nordström black hole, that's a charged black hole, which has the maximal charge allowed by, that Jim will allow us to, by cosmic censorship. And if you get very near the horizon, which is an infinite spatial distance away, you find that the geometry dramatically simplifies. Near the horizon, it just becomes a two-sphere of constant radius times two-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. That's called the Robinson-Bertotti universe, and this was discovered in 1959. And if you go to this very near horizon region, here I've drawn a picture of it. If you go to this very near horizon region, it's not an exact symmetry of the whole solution, but it is an exact symmetry of the near horizon solution the exact symmetry is that in addition to the spatial rotational invariance, the time translation invariance gets enhanced. And it gets enhanced to SO2,1, which is the global conformal group in 1+1 dimensions, and this group includes a scaling symmetry which moves one up and down in this near horizon region. So mathematically, it's identical to the kind of scaling symmetry that you encounter at low energies in 1+1 condensed matter systems. Now I want to talk about Kerr black holes. So cosmic censorship bounds the angular momentum that a black hole of a fixed mass can have. And what happens is, one heuristic way of describing it is that the horizon of the black hole moves around, proportional, has an angular velocity proportional to the spin, and there's some maximal value of the spin at which the horizon is spinning at the speed of light, and if you go faster than that, Jim will arrest you. And so that is the maximal black hole, and it's important to realize that these things have been seen. So in fact, the most studied black hole in the universe, which is the most visible, is this GRS 1915 and +105, and its spin has been measured to be within 2% of light speed. The measurements are consistent with it being at light speed. There's also a nearby supermassive black hole in the galaxy MC63015, which is known to be 1% below light speed. And the famous Cygnus X1 is now believed to be 2% below light speed. And in fact, there are many things that astronomers, astrophysicists don't understand. There's only about 20 black holes whose spins have been measured with this accuracy. And the fact that three of them would end up within 1% of extremality is highly improbable. So there's some reason that we don't understand and that they don't have any explanation for of why high spins are so common. But they are, and that's good for us. It could be, but if you ask them why, that is not the explanation they give. They don't know. There isn't the commonly accepted explanation of why there are so many high spin ones. No, that would be the obvious explanation. It's true that the accretion spins them up, but there have been estimates of how fast the accretion spins them up, and it's not enough to explain the preponderance of high spin black holes. That one I know has been and the fact that the accretion spins them up is, again, very much like attraction to a fixed point. You know, it's a very familiar to what we've seen in other branches of physics. So here's an artist rendition of GRS 1915. And this is why it's been measured so much, is it has this partner here, which is feeding matter to a very luminous accretion disk, and by looking at the emission of X-rays from this accretion disk, so here's GRS 1915 in the middle, which, by the way, has a highly collimated jet. Another thing that they don't understand, which looks like some kind of critical behavior, is that these jets are incredibly highly collimated. Sometimes their width, the ratio of their width to their length is a tiny fraction of a percent. They can be thousands and thousands of times longer than they are wide, and something like that should have some simple explanation, but there are few proposals, but nothing universally accepted. And it's also known observationally that the faster they spin, the thinner these jets, the more collimated the jets are. So no explanation for that. Okay, so now I want to talk about the famous work of Bardeen and and Horowitz, which, so Bertotti and Robinson noticed that there was a scaling solution of extreme Rostrum-Norstrom in 1959. The Kerr metric was around from 1963, but it wasn't until 1999, 40 years after Bertotti and Robinson, that it was realized that extreme Kerr has a similar, algebraically quite a bit more complicated, but quite a similar near horizon scaling limit. And not only that, so that's what we're going to be interested in, and there's an enhanced conformal symmetry there. And NASA has even made a video of the Bardeen-Horowitz near horizon scaling. Here we go. Whoops. Ah. Darn it. So this is a video of the approach to the fixed point, which is this tiny little dot in the middle with a jet emerging out of it. And so our goal, that's the critical point, that's what we want to understand. Our goal is to understand that little point in the sky. And now, one of the things, these black holes, many of them like JRS-1915, the ones we know the most about, are surrounded by accretion disks. And the accretion disk ends at what's called the innermost stable circular orbit. It doesn't go all the way to the horizon. It ends before you get to the horizon. And once anything gets to the innermost stable circular orbit, it just plunges and doesn't radiate anymore. So the accretion disk has an edge. But that one of the really interesting things is that that edge approaches the horizon itself, and the redshift of the last stable circular orbit goes to infinity at extremality. And that means that the redshift of the stuff coming out of the accretion disk diverges at the critical point. And for that reason, it's actually astronomically quite easy to tell how close you are to extremality. And so, for example, even though JRS-1915, it's known to be within a couple percent of extremality, its mass is only known to something like a factor of 2. That's much, much harder to measure. So the things that we would want to know about are the things that are easy to measure. Now, the SO2,1 conformal symmetry is not the end of the story, just like the global conformal symmetry of the Ising model at large distances is not everything there is to say about the symmetries of that system. Just like in the Ising model, the global symmetry gets enhanced to an infinite dimensional local symmetry group. And probably it's for the same kind of reasons that it always happens in 1 plus 1 dimensional conformal field theory. It's just a mathematically, it's a thing that mathematically wants to happen. And the way that you show this, this is something we showed in 2008, the way that you show this is using standard techniques in general relativity that began with the same kind of things that Bondi, Vandenberg, Messner, and Sachs used to show that you have the infinite dimensional BMS group at null infinity, also that Brown and Hanau used for the infinite dimensional group of ADS3. And this group is the same as the group, it's the two-dimensional, infinite dimensional conformal group. Now, computationally, this means, what does this mean in practice? What is this good for? Well, it's good for a lot, actually. It means in practice that if you want to compute some scattering off an extreme Kerr black hole, you can sort of cut out this near region and replace it by a 1+1 dimensional conformal field theory, and you can use all the techniques developed over many decades for doing calculations in 1+1 dimensional conformal field theory and the power of the infinite dimensional conformal group to do calculations involving extreme Kerr black holes. And I'm going to call this the weak Kerr CFT correspondence. And it's not a new law of physics or a conjecture. It is simply a rewriting of the Einstein equation in a manner that makes the conformal symmetry that appears in this region manifest. It's exploiting the symmetries. Now, to clarify what I mean by this as an aside, I want to say that if we want to talk, which I'm not going to today, about quantum gravity on NEC, it's natural to presume that this symmetry is also relevant there. And this existence of the symmetry, together with the analogy to ADS-CFT, motivates the strong Kerr CFT, which is certainly a conjecture that quantum gravity on NEC is dual to some kind of probably warped two-dimensional conformal field theory. And if this conjecture is right, it is relevant to black hole entropy for these extreme Kerr guys. But that's a conjecture, and that's not what I'm talking about. That's a subject for a different talk. So what I want to go on to talk about today are what are the observational consequences of the extreme Kerr conformal symmetry. Yeah, good question. I shouldn't be drawing myself on the. Okay, so as I said, one can excise this near horizon region, and we could, for example, compute scattering. The first thing one would try to do is to compute wave scattering of scalars or gravity waves or anything by using techniques from 1+1 dimensional conformal field theory. And indeed, if you look at these old papers of Tucholsky and Press, who famously, this is a solved problem, who famously solved what separated the wave equation in Kerr, and Chandrasekhar has written a long book on this. John Cardy, who's sitting there, will look at this and say, wait, that's a finite temperature conformal field theory correlation function, which in fact is exactly what it is. So these results from Tucholsky and Press, including every last little factor, number, and coefficient in here, can be reproduced by doing a calculation in two-dimensional conformal field theory. And this had to work because the existence of this conformal field theory is just a rewriting of the Einstein equation. And there's a lot of examples of that. But of course, we do not hope to measure, we don't hope to measure any kind of scattering of waves off black holes. Astronomers don't have experiments set up for that. So what kind of things are they looking at that we might measure? Well, one of the proposed signals that for ELISA or even advanced LIGO, that depending on which paper you read, should happen about once a year to once every. It's not 1 to 5,000 per year. It's 1 every year or 5,000 years. No, wait, maybe it is. Wait, no, I forgot. Wait. No, sorry. No, that is right. It's 1. No, the extreme optimists are saying that this should happen 5,000 times a year. And that is, you have a supermassive black hole, and you have a stellar mass object that falls into it, which we can think of as a point-like object, and it emits a gravity wave signal, which then would be powerful enough. This is a violent process, and that would be powerful enough to try to measure at ELISA. And indeed, and one of the more visible supermassive black holes is moving, is spinning. This happens, it would fall off the ISCO. So this is a process which occurs entirely within the region where the dynamics are governed by the conformal symmetry. So now you need to calculate this process, and various people, the way this has mostly been done in the astrophysics community is you start, first the problem is solved for Schwarzschild, and then you do perturbation theory in, these problems are solved numerically, and then you do perturbation theory in the spin and try to correct the example, try to correct it. But we were actually able, using the symmetry, to solve this problem analytically. And we did that in several steps. And this was a calculation that astrophysicists had been trying to do. And the first step was to, this is a problem that you might have been able to solve without knowing about the symmetry, that it hadn't been solved. But we looked at a star on the ISCO of an extreme Kerr black hole and found an analytic expression. And we, you know, using the Kerr CFT dictionary, it's related by Fermi's golden rule to the two-point function of an operator. And we could compute this analytically. And then we used conformal symmetry. And here, actually, because we're moving the horizon, it's not just the SL2R. We have to use the whole infinite dimensional conformal symmetry group to map this to the circular orbit, to a plunging orbit, which crosses the horizon, because the conformal infinite dimensional conformal symmetry enables you to move the horizon around. And it's almost certain that this never could have been computed without knowing about this symmetry. And in fact, we just had a third paper, I think yesterday or today, in which we, the last one was where, which is what the astrophysicists usually consider, where it circulates around the ISCO and then just infinitesimally drops off and spirals in. But most stars which fall in are known to arrive at the ISCO with some eccentricity. So you have a more dramatic plunge. And that also can be solved, it turns out, to map into a quantum quench in the dual conformal field theory, again, by a conformal mapping. But there's lots of other things that we can try to use this conformal symmetry to understand. So I'd like to mention now something about the equations of force-free electrodynamics. And when I first understood what they were only a year or two ago, I was really kind of astonished, because as far as nonlinear equations in physics, I think they, PDEs in physics, they sort of stand with the Navier-Stokes equation and the Einstein equations as nonlinear, very interesting nonlinear equations that that are very important physically and have a very interesting structure and can't be solved analytically. These equations, I don't know when they were first written down, but their importance in astrophysics was pointed out or accepted in around 1974 from the famous work of Blanford and Znaek. And they govern the behavior of the electromagnetic field in the presence of a plasma, and when there's a dilute plasma. And that they are believed to govern the magnetospheres around most black holes and also be relevant around most stars. And So we want these. So these are very beautiful, but highly relevant physically and poorly understood equations. Now, Blanford ends. Okay. So Blanford and Znaek. So it looks. Here's what astrophysical black holes look like. There's an accretion disk, or the ones that we can observe tend to have accretion disks. And then there's a plasma around the black hole. And the process of energy extraction from a black hole is believed to be described by these equations of force-free electromagnetism. And it's the electromagnetic field which actually does the work of mining the energy out of the ergosphere. And that energy that comes out of the ergosphere, as everybody knows that watched Interstellar, is important for powering all kinds of processes, not only the return of their spaceship, but many of the dramatic signals that we see in the sky are ultimately powered by this energy extraction. Now, despite the importance of these equations, let me come to that in a minute. So, energy extraction requires spin. You can't get energy out of a Schwarzschild black hole. It has to be a Kerr black hole. Moreover, it occurs near the horizon. So the usual method for studying energy extraction is to start with a Schwarzschild black hole, do some perturbation theory, and do numerics, which tends to break down just as you get near the interesting region, which is high spin. So it's clear that if we want to, in some cases, it's what we are actually seeing. In any case, it would seem that this neck region is exactly where we want to be to study the physics of energy extraction, but because it's a much better idea to expand around maximal spin than zero spin, where the effect actually occurs. Now, amazingly, essentially, except for trivial cases, no exact analytic solutions of these force-free equations were known until maybe 2 years ago when Sam Graya and Ted Jacobson found an infinite family of solutions. And then our various groups, including my group at Harvard, that the exact solutions have been sort of tumbling out. And in the context of this neck geometry, one can use the conformal symmetry to generate large infinite families of exact solutions. And it's not impossible that that this equations can actually be solved. We're not sure. We've found an awful lot of solutions. We don't really know. But our hope is that by studying these solutions, we can get an improved conceptual understanding of a black hole energy extraction. And just to give you an idea of how complicated these solutions are, I've just a little video here of, and because using the conformal symmetry, this is not a numerical simulation of the equations, this is a graph of an exact solution of the electromagnetic field around a solution of these equations near the a time-dependent solution. Because we have the conformal symmetry, we can actually find analytic time-dependent solutions. So that's one little clip. All right, so now I'm almost done. I just want to talk about two projects which are new and in progress, but I'm excited about them, so I'm going to mention them. The first is, these are plots out of the paper of Brenneman and Reynolds when they find the spin of the supermassive black hole at the middle of this galaxy. So they did some simulation. So what they did is they look at the iron line. And what you see here is this is Schwarzschild, and this is extreme Kerr, and the three plots represent different angles of inclination of the accretion disk relative to the line of sight. And what happens is, ordinarily the iron line should just be a, so they're looking at the emission from the iron line, that should just be a peak, you know, one thing. But what happens is, because the accretion disks exists into, goes into a region of where there's some redshift, it gets broadened to the left. And this is what it looks like for Schwarzschild, a sort of complicated looking curve. But we see that there's, for extreme Kerr, and the neck region, somehow it didn't show up here, but the neck region is here at high redshift. For extreme Kerr, you get this very simple and beautiful looking curve. And since all the physics in this region is governed by the conformal symmetry, the shape and the slope of this curve should be understandable. This would be a postdiction, should be understandable as some kind of critical exponent, because the system is near the emissions in this region are coming from near criticality. These are calculations which use very complicated models and very, very massive numerical simulations. And the data, which is elsewhere in this same paper, compares the observation to these two sets of curves and definitively concludes that it must be very close to this picture here. Okay, now another thing I want to mention, some of my beautiful colors are gone here, but okay, so is a very interesting thing in progress now, which is this Event Horizon Telescope. And what the Event Horizon Telescope is going to do is to synchronize several radio telescopes on Earth, about six of them located around the world, and use VLBI to get increased resolution. And it turns out that in a certain submillimeter wavelength range, they are going to be able to see electromagnetic radiations coming from the two biggest black holes in the sky. And that's the ones that subtend the most solid angle. And that's Sagittarius A star, which is in the middle of our own galaxy. And then the much bigger supermassive, further away, but much bigger supermassive black hole at the middle of M87. And they are actually going to be able to, by comparing the arrival times of the various signals, they are actually going to be able to get a resolution, they hope, to within a couple Schwarzschild radii of these black holes. And they're also going to be able to measure the polarization. And this is starting up now. So within a couple of years, we are going to be able to have a map with angular and polarization dependence of the electromagnetic emissions from the magnetosphere around both M87 and Sagittarius A star. But the Event Horizon Telescope is going to, I mean, it's going to be fuzzy, but it's going to have, it's going to, they don't have that now, but they are going to have. I mean, it's a very exciting thing. You know, all the evidence for black holes before has been inferential. You know, if they look at the stars, the orbits around Sagittarius A star, now they are actually literally going to be seeing on the order of a Schwarzschild radius, and how much. And there isn't some, and how much they will be able to improve, and that's in the next year or two, how much they will be able to improve that in the coming decades, we don't know.
Well, I think the estimates are within 3 or 4 years, it will be up to sub-horizon scale.
In 3 or 4 years, it will be sub-horizon scale, right. In the next year or two, it's going to be, so we're racing, so M87 has a highly collimated jet, Its spin hasn't been measured, but it's known that black holes with highly collimated jets tend to be rapidly rotating. So the hope is that M87 is near enough to extremality that the conformal symmetry applies. So it's a straightforward but rather difficult calculation to understand what conformal symmetry predicts about the signal and the polarization distribution of the electromagnetic emissions coming from M87. So in closing, it's very likely conformal symmetry appears in the sky. Maybe we've already seen it in some sense in these iron lines. It is certainly computationally powerful. You can compute things that, in fact, computers have a very hard time. Things, they tend to blow up near a critical point. So just where things get interesting, the computer programs get bad. What we would really like is some kind of dramatic smoking gun, like the critical opalescent in the carbon liquid gas phase transition, some dramatic qualitative phenomena that is a result of the conformal symmetry. There could be such a thing, and we're looking at many, many processes and hope to find it. And if there are any astrophysicists in the audience, we need your help.
Thank you. Well, we have a little time for questions and discussion before the break. Once again, the microphone. Have it or loud.
So yes, one question, one comment. So this is very interesting. Have you looked at these claims of Kerr black holes as particle accelerators of, I guess, Joe Silk and others in papers where sort of formally it looks like you could get very, very high energy scattering?
Yeah,
and does
so,
that play a role here?
So I mean, that is really an incredibly interesting thing, which is that Kerr black holes are just so interesting, extreme. I think it is true that if you had an exactly extreme Kerr black hole, you could drop two particles and send them in exactly the right way, and they would collide with a center of mass energy that in this idealized world could be made arbitrarily large and certainly well above the Planck mass.
So
however, the fellow behind you, Dr. Jacobson, Professor Jacobson, in reality, you know, they're not extreme. They're not exactly extreme. And if they're 1% extreme and you have a little loss of relativity, then you really lose a lot. And so the prospects for doing something better than the LHC, still, you know, it's cool that that happens. And, you know, I think it points more in the direction that there really could be a lot of interesting things learned from looking at these extreme Kerr black holes.
So for you, is that IR physics still, because it's very near the horizon, even though it's UV from a standard point of view?
Well, certainly the way I'm setting it up, it's IR physics.
The other comment was just, you said astrophysics has been left out of the fun, and I would beg to differ, I think, in the CMB. That's quite the opposite.
Well, of course, my first line was the CMB, and there it's very much, yeah.
Other questions, comments? All right.
Just a quick clarification. I mean, this is beautiful stuff, but I'm always conceptually confused about the following point.
Yeah.
So where this conformal symmetry comes into play in the near horizon geometry.
Yeah.
So if I'm doing some processes there, I got this huge symmetry and I can use them to solve equations exactly, etc. But what Lisa is interested or something is really signals here. I mean, we're not close to them. And so therefore there is a propagation, right, of all these things.
Right. So
and that is certainly not conformally, you know, there's no conformal symmetry.
Right.
So there's a
matching problem, right? It, just like when you're solving the wave equation the complicated part of the wave equation is in this near region. So you have to match the near region to the flat region. And the matching problem can get really complicated.
Right.
And there's a lot of, you know, so that is That is...
Okay.
Yeah.
So that is
most of the work that we're in trying to get what the signal is from. And you think you understand it until you actually try to do it. And that that is most of the problem we're having in understanding how to, yeah.
We're trespassing on coffee, but we'll take one last.
Physical discussion where H bar comes in. Because presumably, the astrophysical predictions you're making don't involve H bar or the Planck scale, whereas you keep talking about conformal field theories as quantum conformal field theories, which have an H bar. Are you talking about a classical conformal field theory?
Well, that's one of the very beautiful things is you know that in these dualities, quantum effects on one side turn into classical effects on the other side.
That's a system with, you know, with very high central charges and so on. So there's a huge scale there which somehow brings the Planck scales down to accessible scales. I don't see how that happens here.
Well, I was about to explain.
You have to be 99.999 to 50 digits of the extreme Kerr black hole, I would think, for these effects to be important. For H bar to come in.
Wait. So, I mean, the statement is that quantum effects in these kind of duality that the classical effects in general relativity, just like in ADS-CFT, can be quantum effects. So to compute a classical process in GR, you may have to compute a quantum process in the dual CFT. Now, if you want to have the quantum effects in the GR, that is the 0.999999.
Yes.
And in order to understand that 0.9999, you would need, in order to understand that all, then you need the strong Kerr CFT.
Yeah.
So that is a conjecture, but that doesn't prevent us from using the conformal symmetry. And indeed, we did it, and there was no, you know, H bar maps into something else, into a classical quantity in the classical GR.
Now, let's see, we have one more from Jenna Eisenberg, then we will have coffee.
Sorry, the central charge is the spin, which is around 10 to the 87 in Planck units. Mm-hmm. So it's a small number. It's huge, right?
So I'm just wondering what happens to these conformal symmetries if you perturb Kerr. So they're, you know, the stability of Kerr mathematically is very tricky. So these things presumably are gone, or are there echoes of it, or what happens there?
Yeah. So the nice thing is, of course, if you get too far away from the symmetry point, we're never going to expect to be exactly at the symmetry point. But if you're near the symmetry point, that should be good. Now, one of the nice things that happens is that the linear perturbation, this is a little bit technical, but the linear perturbation going linearly away from the conformal point can be understood is going to a thermal state in the conformal field theory. So you still have the full power of the conformal field to linear order. To quadratic order, things get really messy. So, and it's a lot like in condensed matter system where the approach, you know, the deviations, if you perturb a conformally invariant condensed matter systems, the linear approach to conformality is often highly constrained and well controlled.
Okay, thank you. I think Andy will be around at coffee, so I think we should adjourn this session.